From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Budget cuts are piling up on budget cuts in Maryland's spending plans. Some of the reductions Governor Hogan has proposed extend subtractions made by then-Governor O'Malley 3 weeks ago. We talked to a state legislator and a mental health service provider about cuts to public mental health. Then, an adaptation of a parody of a soap opera. Theater artist Maggie Villegas has adapted the TV soap opera parody Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman for Baltimore's Annex Theater. Tom Hall talks with Villegas and actress Carly J. Bales. Plus, we take a visit to the banks of the Loch Raven Reservoir to check out the area's wildlife and learn how it inspired a local photographer's book for young readers called The Swan at Loch Raven. Now, news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. If you follow the news in Maryland, you've been hearing about budget cuts. Not just since last week, when Governor Hogan presented his budget the day after he was inaugurated, but 3 weeks ago, when outgoing Democratic Governor O'Malley shepherded a set of budget cuts through the Board of Public Works to take effect immediately. This morning, we're looking in depth at one particular area, mental health. About 160,000 adults and children in Maryland use public mental health services, a number that's increased by more than half in the last decade, especially with the advent of Obamacare, which requires most health insurance plans to cover mental health and substance use disorder services. Here in the studio with me is Lori Doyle, Public Policy Director for the Community Behavioral Health Association of Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone from Annapolis is the new chair of the Public Health Subcommittee of the House Health and Government Operations Committee, Delegate Jocelyn Pena-Melnick of Prince George's and Anne Arundel Counties. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Delegate Pena-Melnick, you and your predecessor, former Delegate Jim Hubbard of Prince George's County, wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun last week complaining that the state is balancing its budget, quote, on the backs of the mentally ill, close quote. What did you mean?
Well, Sheila, you know, the need for behavioral health services in Maryland has steadily increased. Available funding has not kept pace. In the past 19 years, for instance, the rate for these services has increased only 6 times, and this year increase was cut in half by the Board of Public Works. And one result of this is that mental health care providers have faced higher turnover rates. These are, you know, the people that give the direct care to our loved ones, you know, cannot get a pay increase. A lot of them get paid like $10, an hour or less sometimes. So making access to services more difficult for this population.
Lori Doyle, what impact are you expecting from these budget cuts?
This is a devastating set of cuts. When we get our rates set by the state, we have to pay all of our associated costs with providing the service through those rates. So it's not only the staff salaries, things like contributions towards staff health insurance, and those things are skyrocketing, rents, fuel costs, implementation of electronic health records, which are obscenely expensive and, again, required. We have to eke all of those out of our rates. So when the rate stays flat or is cut, it compromises our ability to do any of those things. And particularly around staff salaries, as the delegate was saying, we have had a long history of no rate increases. We thought we were getting a 4% rate increase effective January 1. So many of us providers went and gave a small, modest, but needed rate increase for our staff, only to find out now that the money's been taken away. We've already given those increases. We can't take them back. We wouldn't want to take them back. So we're faced with how we're going to balance our budget, and that probably means program closures, layoffs, and other undesirable outcomes.
And tell me who these workers are that we're looking to a raise and not getting it.
These are direct care staff who are the backbone of our organizations. These are the people who go in and provide face-to-face services, help people manage their medications, make sure they're taking the medications, the right ones at the right time, help people get to their doctor appointments, help them get housing. We will see people in their own homes. We will see people under a bridge if it's necessary. So whatever it takes, these are the direct line people. These are the ones who intervene when someone is decompensating, maybe suicidal, maybe feeling aggressive. It is the direct line staff who first notice that and make sure that an intervention is taken to avoid a problem.
Delegate Pendant Malnick, is the root of the problem the decision to cut reimbursement for providers in the Medicaid program, or are there other cuts that affect mental health in addition to the Medicaid cuts?
Well, you know, Sheila, the problem goes beyond Medicaid. The 2% reduction in state agency spending will almost certainly be felt to some degree by Medicare recipients, and reductions in state spending for Medicaid will by necessity affect our federal matching funds. And the full effect of these cuts in state agency spending cannot be measured until each agency determines where its 2% cut will come from. And for example, you know, some of the cuts that were made was basically the cuts for this budget cuts the rates for behavioral health administration providers to FY 2014 levels. And these cuts are devastating, like the rate was cut for psychiatric treatment as well.
Yeah, I think that one of the major issues for us is not only our direct line staff were cut. We were hit three times, basically, two by outgoing Governor O'Malley and once by the incoming Governor Hogan. Not only the 4% to 2% for our direct line staff, but the evaluation and management codes, the E&M codes, those are the codes that our psychiatrists bill when you go in for an office visit. And they were cut from 100% of Medicare to 87%. So it was a 13% cut. We are already having a hard time attracting and retaining psychiatrists and psychiatric nurse practitioners, our prescribers. We're competing with hospital systems, with the VA, with much better resourced organizations. And our outpatient clinics where these psychiatrists and nurse practitioners work are the MASH units of the public mental health system. These are where people go when they're a danger to self or others, when they are in desperate need of medication, and we are having a hard time staffing them.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Lori Doyle with the Professional Association of Community Behavioral Health Providers and with Democratic Delegate Jocelyn Pelnia-Melnick, Chair of the Public Health Subcommittee in the Maryland House. We're talking about budget cuts to Medicaid and mental health services. Delegate Pelnia-Melnick, you and Delegate Hubbard were writing particularly about the cuts that Governor O'Malley proposed during his last weeks in office. How does the budget proposed by Governor Hogan last week affect the picture?
You know, this budget has a lot of cuts, Sheila, to what we call essential services, which are education cuts, health care cuts, cuts to state workforce. For example, I represent Prince George's County and Anne Arundel counties. Those two counties, Prince George's County is expected under this budget. And again, everything is up for negotiation. He proposes it and we have to negotiate. But the cuts, as they are reflected now, we're going to lose something like $38 million. In Anne Arundel County, almost $12 million. And for example, the University of Maryland system, which we have for the last 8 years capped tuition, they're basically going to increase it this year by 20% under this budget, the way it is, you know, proposed presently. And the state workforce, state employees, will get a cut of 2%. You know, that means less pay for every state police officer, correction officer, every security guard in state buildings. So this is a cut, a budget that does not reflect well on essential services.
And I should say, we did try to reach Governor Hogan's budget team, and we hadn't connected by the time of this interview, and we hope to have that conversation. But you said we're going to negotiate, Delegate Pelnia-Melnick. It's not quite clear to me what tools the Democratic legislature has to negotiate with Governor Hogan, since, as I understand it, you cannot add money back to his budget. You could only cut further. Or do I misunderstand the dynamic?
No, we have a constitutional requirement to pass a balanced budget each year. And after he introduces the budget, we can reduce or restrict the money in the budget. And we have conversations with him. okay, we can talk to him and we can sort of educate him on the different departments, okay? He has a new administration, so he will be able to show him what the impact will be on this budget and how it affects, you know, the people that we represent. And I think that it's, you know, there will most certainly be a spirited debate about the budget this year, as there is every year with the deficit that we have. But, you know, we're here to talk, and we are talking, and I'm hopeful that we can work it out by the time we adjourn on April 14th, because we have a constitutional requirement to pass a balanced budget.
MedCHI, Maryland's Medical Society, argued about the cuts early in January in at the Board of Public Works that reducing Medicaid reimbursements would end up costing the state more money. Lori Doyle, how does that look to you?
Well, I absolutely agree with them. I mean, on a couple levels. As the delegate has pointed out, first off, you're giving up 50% federal match. So you're leaving federal dollars on the table. But secondly, it's the cost of not providing community care. So when the clinics are full and you can't get an appointment and you can't get your meds, or if you can't get housing and you're in a state of distress, well, you don't miraculously get cured, you go to the emergency department or you go for an inpatient stay. And the costs associated with that go up exponentially. All of the data show that both for Medicare and Medicaid, individuals with behavioral health conditions, the outcomes are lousy. Health outcomes are bad. The ED utilization is high. Utilization is high. Inpatient utilization is high. And the health outcomes are worse. So until we get a handle on providing care in the community, the costs associated with this population are going to continue to go up.
And, you know, we don't know the full impact yet. I mean, we're just reviewing it. But, for example, this budget cuts health coverage for pregnant women making $22,000 per year. Okay? These are real people with real needs and problems. And we're here to take care of them.
And I will keep in touch with you as this develops. I really appreciate your talking to us. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Delegate Jocelyn Peña-Melnick, a Democrat, chairs the Public Health Subcommittee of the House Health and Government Operations Committee. Lori Doyle is the Public Policy Director for the Community Behavioral Health Association of Maryland. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also there, a link to a new report about mental health services covered by private insurance. The Parity Project of the Mental Health Association of Maryland checked all the psychiatrists listed in the networks of the qualified health plans being sold on the state's insurance exchange. It found less than half the listed psychiatrists were reachable, and only 1 in 7 was accepting new patients and available for an appointment within 45 days. For a link to the report, go to wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. After the news, an adaptation of a parody of a soap opera. On stage. Sure. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. The Annex Theater is one of 6 local companies that has formed a group called Le Mondo, an arts incubator and set of venues that they hope to build on Howard Street in Baltimore's Bromo Tower Arts and Entertainment District. Annex will partner with Acme Corporation, Still Point Theater Initiative, and the EMP Collective, among others, to build new performance spaces and to create a place where local artists and community members will develop new work. Well, two of the founders of the EMP Collective are with me this morning in Studio A. Maggie Villegas and Carly Bales are also working with the Annex Theater in their current production. It's a play called Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. Now, folks of a certain age will remember that iconic cult TV show from the 1970s, which poked fun at soap operas. The Annex Theater show was adapted for the stage by Maggie Villegas, and it stars Carly Bales as Mary Hartman. Welcome to you both. Good to see you.
Hello. Good morning.
So, Maggie, how does a 1970s sitcom end up as fodder for you as a director and theater artist for a live play?
Well, I actually was mutual friends with a student of Greg Mulvey's who played Tom Hartman on the original production, and she introduced me to the show, and as a fan of absurdist existential material, I was immediately drawn to the piece. I thought that it was well-suited for the stage, and later learned after watching many, many episodes that the first two episodes had actually been filmed as a stage production. And I thought it was a great piece that nobody I knew in my age group had heard of, other than the people who had lived to see it when it was on the air. So I wanted to bring it back.
Yeah. So how did you approach this then? I was at the play the other night, and then I looked at the first episode on YouTube of Mary Hartman, and I was in college. I was younger than you are now. You're in your mid-20s. I was in my early 20s, you know, by the time it came on the air. So I do have a recollection of it. I remember it being very funny. It takes place in Fernwood, Ohio. And there was another offshoot of that called Fernwood Tonight, which starred a guy that I actually knew a little bit when he and I were in Boston together. So I was interested in that. But the first episode seems to mirror the first act of your play fairly closely. And then what happens after that?
So it was a big challenge to try to get a show that had over 300 episodes and try to distill the essence of that into one night of theater that an audience could absorb. And so in terms of approaching the script, I wanted to, well, first treat it with a great deal of respect because I have a lot of respect for the writers of the original production, but also to create a narrative that introduces these characters as if somebody had never seen them before. And so it was really important to sort of follow along with how those characters are introduced in the beginning of the original production, just because you don't want to just dive in and assume people know everything that's happening. And, you know, it sort of draws you into the characters' lives. As the show progresses, it starts to veer further and further away from the original storyline, sort of plucking pieces that had the highest impact on Mary's life. And really, it follows Mary's descent into madness, mm-hmm. essentially.
Carly, you affect that descent on stage. So for folks who aren't familiar with Mary Hartman, tell us about her and her various neuroses.
Well, I mean, she was sort of created in my mind as this every woman in some sense. She's this working class 1970s housewife. She has a daughter and a husband who works in a factory. Her parents live down the street. She's best friends with her neighbor. And for me, one of the big points to hone in on was the fact that she was raised sort of in this 1950s mentality and is now at the crux of this new sort of social liberation in the 1970s, especially with women's lib, sexual revolution, and things like that. And she's trying to process this new information with sort of the way that she's learned to interact with the world, and she's kind of doing it to disastrous results. I mean, I think a huge part of this story and these characters is their complete lack of ability to communicate with each other on any real level.
And much of Mary's orientation to the world is premised on television and watching the ads.
Sure, absolutely.
One of the great touches in your production with the Annex Theater is these teleplays that you have that one watches on an old-fashioned TV before the show starts. Explain what those are and how you came to create those.
Well, you know, as you said, in the show and in our play, commercials and television and media are a huge way of are a huge sort of pathway for Mary into these new worlds that are opening up. But she's still sort of translating them through this very antiquated mode of communication in her life. So we had a really talented video designer, Rachel Dwiggins, who's worked with us before at EMP on such plays as Condo, Condo, Condo Land. And she also worked on the Annex Theaters, The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover. She basically took commercials from the era in major products and sort of spliced them in with recreations of actors who were in the play. So you're kind of introduced to the play with this weird feedback loop of characters you will see in the play later playing these sort of archetypical commercial characters for feminine hygiene and Schlitz beer and, you know, Goodyear tires, things like that.
Right. The Goodyear tire one is particularly funny. It's like you need safe tires when a woman drives. And there's this whole thing about
right.
a woman driving late at night and it's raining and stuff. And it's the reason
dangerous.
To buy the tires is a woman is, you know, just a priori a dangerous creature driving this thing. There's some really funny
There's definitely things. Her curation of those commercials and the ones that she shot are definitely veered towards this weird sense of femininity changing in the 1970s.
Carly Bales is the star of Mary Hartman. Mary Hartman at the Annex Theater. Maggie Vijaygas joins us in the studio as well. It's on 88.1. It's Marilyn Morning, and I'm Tom Hall. So, Maggie, you mentioned this challenge to you as the adapter of the script and the director of the show to give folks a frame of reference who don't know the show. It's amazing to think that this was only on for a couple of years, right? Like 1976, 1977. But they did 325 episodes. I mean, right now, a series, you know, House of Cards, you know, is going to make a big splash in a few weeks when they release 13 more episodes. This is the amount of work that they did back then was astonishing.
Well, I mean, and it was an exhausting piece for the people who produced it originally as well. You know, there's well-documented cases of the wear and tear that this project had on the original Mary Hartman, Louise Lasser.
Louise Lasser, yeah.
And it was treated very much like a, like a soap opera. They were on the same soap opera schedule where they shot every day. And it was very important to them, and in terms of framing this piece as well, to honor the soap opera medium, just because it was completely designed, even when it was on the radio, to sell products to women, essentially. And that was the genesis of the medium, and we really wanted to explore that in the piece.
This is a Norman Lear thing that, mm-hmm. that sort of, you know, took soap operas to task. Very interesting. Now, the list of credits in the program here is sort of indicative of what's going on in the theater scene and the DIY community, as it's known here in Baltimore. And you guys, I think, are great exemplars of that, because here you are working well. I mean, I take that as a high compliment, because it is. But there's so many interconnections. So you guys are doing the show at the Annex Theater. You're also two of the folks, along with some other people, who founded the EMP Collective. Mm-hmm. And then the EMP Collective and the Annex Theater, as well as a few other groups, are going to get together and form this other consortium called Le Mondo. So the interconnections here are just astonishing. And when you look at the program for the Annex Theater, with the people like who did the teleplays and the people who do the production design and all the other facets of it, it's really tremendous to think that there's so many people working. So let's take this sort of one thing at a time. Let's start with the EMP Collective, Carly.
Yes.
What was your purpose in forming this sort of consortium of different artists? Because EMP is not just devoted only to theater.
Correct.
You do all sorts of other stuff, too.
Well, I think that just derived from a group of people who were all immensely talented and came from wildly different backgrounds. I moved to the region in 2009, and I'd known Maggie from college and knew that she was living and working in Baltimore, and I really wanted to work on a project, a devised theater piece with a group of people, but I didn't know anyone. So Maggie and I got together and were able to amass a small group of people to devise our first theater piece in Baltimore called We're All Gonna Die. It was sort of all thematically linked to sort of post-apocalyptic ideas. And it just sort of...
Or in Baltimore when it snows. Either way.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, this
it wasn't
during,
January.
It wasn't during the snowpocalypse, actually, coincidentally. So it just sort of blossomed out of that for that need to create and work with people from from different backgrounds and sort of meld and modulate our talents together into this completely new thing. I always tell people I got a degree in theater, but I was the worst theater student possible. And I think that a few of us who did have a theater background kind of felt the same way, is that we were always looking for a little bit more and a little bit something different. And we found it in each other.
And cue the violins. Very nice. But Maggie, it's not just theater. I mean, you have visual art exhibitions, you have music, you have poetry slams, you have all sorts of stuff. Tell us about what's going on this weekend. On Friday night, there's an opening reception for an artist named Amanda Burnham, who's doing something that she calls a living drawing. What's that all about?
So Amanda Burnham is an amazing visual artist. She is doing a project called RFP, where she's essentially asking the city of Baltimore to respond to what they want to see Baltimore look like. And so she's going to have it'll be the opening reception this Saturday, but she's going to have open gallery hours where she's collaborating with anybody that's coming into the space to help inform what that drawing will be, and that'll culminate in a closing reception.
So this is an example of an artist who really is trying to get ideas, inspiration, and physical involvement from other artists and non-artists, too, right? I mean, this is sort of open to everybody.
Well, most definitely. The idea, Amanda does these large-scale 2D installations and drawings that are mostly urban landscapes, so she's taken on the ambitious task of basically transforming our space down on Baltimore Street into this sort of quote-unquote ideal city. What do we want Baltimore to be now? What do we want it to be in the future? And she's looking for input from anyone and everyone. She's done tours in schools. She's worked with classes, things like that already. So this is definitely a huge community project.
And this group that you're putting together with EMP and Annex and Stillpoint Theater Initiative and some other groups called Le Mondo, you've got a community charrette going on for them Saturday afternoon. It's a busy weekend for you guys.
Yes, most definitely.
We don't sleep.
Yeah, evidently. So what is your idea there? This is a bunch of theater groups that are going to get, and other groups that are going to get together. And Maggie, what do you hope this thing's going to look like in 3 years once it's built?
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm hoping that this meeting on Saturday will help inform that, really. We want to create a destination corridor on Howard Street. It used to be a theater district. We'd like to bring that back. We want to see as many members of the arts community involved in this project. The more investment that we have from the arts community and from the surrounding communities in this project, the longer it'll last and the higher impact it'll have. As you noted before, we're a very open group of people. We love collaborating, and we've found that we always come to the best result whenever we open up our process as much as possible and invite as many people in. We're a very welcoming organization.
Yeah, you are indeed. And the community aspect of this, the placement in Baltimore, the role of the city itself, Carly, really is a very important parameter of all the work that you do, whether it be a theater piece or anything else.
Absolutely.
I mean, is that something that comes from, I mean, where does that come from? Is that something that's part of your training, or is that, you know?
I just think it's part of, at least for me and Maggie, our preferred aesthetic and process way to work. I certainly come up with great ideas, but my ideas always become greater when I incorporate other voices, other worldviews, other modes of operation.
Two heads are better than one. Yeah.
It's true.
All right. Well, it's great to see you both, and break a leg with the rest of the run of this show and all the other stuff you guys got going on. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Maggie Villegas adopted and directed the Annex Theater's production of Mary Hartman, Mary Harton. Carly Bales stars in the show. It's at the Chicken Box at the corner of Charles Street and North Avenue in the Station North Arts and Entertainment District. It's there until a week from Sunday, and then over at the EMP Collective on West Baltimore on Friday night. Maggie, you said Saturday night. The website says Friday night. Amanda Burnham's thing?
It's Saturday.
All right, on Saturday night, then, there's an opening celebration for a new living drawing by the artist Amanda Burnham. Gamble Cosmos will perform. That starts at 7, and on a Saturday afternoon, the members of the new arts incubator called Le Mondo will hold a community charrette at the Current Gallery. That meeting starts at 2 o'clock, so we've got links to all this stuff on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. And I'm strolling along the banks of Loch Raven Reservoir, one of the three primary sources of drinking water to the Baltimore area. It's also the home to some amazing wildlife. The sounds that you're hearing are those of Canada geese and seagulls floating in the water near Goose Island or walking around the banks of Loch Raven. There are all sorts of species that spend their time around the reservoir. Herons, beavers, turtles, even some swans. Photographer David Simpson has documented that wildlife, including one particularly spectacular swan, in a new book for very young readers. The book is called The Swan at Loch Raven, and David Simpson is here at the reservoir with me for a little exploration of its wildlife. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's great being here. It's the first time I've actually had somebody follow me around with a microphone.
Tell us how you came in contact with the swan that's the focus of this book.
I was just motoring along. I attached two small battery motors to my kayak so I can be silent, so I don't frighten the wildlife. And I'm motoring along as slowly as I can, approaching a blue heron. And all of a sudden, a freight train type of noise I hear to the back of me, which I've never heard before on Loch Raven. And it ended up being this swan. Both of his huge wings were on both sides of my ears. From the back, he flew over top of me, just grazing the top of my head. And he crashed in front of my kayak.
How close was he to you?
He was certainly close enough that I could feel the wind from his wings, and whether he actually physically touched me, I'm not really sure.
It certainly felt like he touched you, whether or not
I'm sure he touched the top of my head, but he certainly didn't hurt me.
So you weren't out looking for the swan. The swan just sort of overtook you.
Yeah, a complete surprise. He splashed in front of me, a big crash, which is in the book, and then he started looking at me, and he wanted me to follow him. I later found out that he was protecting his family. So he was leading me to the right, and the family was to the left. But instead of following him, I made a full circle, and he took off, and he did exactly the same thing again. He buffeted the top of my head with his wings, crashed again, and hence the reason I got the photographs. I would have never gotten those photographs had I not done it a second time. All this took place probably within 5 to 10 minutes.
Once you had those photographs, did you immediately think of putting them into a book?
I didn't really think about it for probably 6 months to a year, and I struggled with a good way about telling kids to be careful of beautiful things and to respect nature, to respect animals, and try to figure out a way to tell a really nice story.
You worked on that story with your daughter, who teaches kindergarten and first grade. What did you do to make that story accessible to kids who are just learning how to read?
I tried to make it that an early reader has words in the book that are big and block letters, and the mom reads the smaller letters, and as the kids get a little older, they can read the entire book. But it's a good beginning book to read to a small child so they can learn how to read.
That's David Simpson. His new book is The Swan at Loch Raven, a book geared at younger kids. I'm Nathan Sterner, and you're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Let's wander over to the point here. It's hard to believe how close we are to Baltimore City here at Loch Raven.
You can make a left coming into this park and see things like this, which is probably 30 or 40 geese, or you can make a right and go to the highway.
I come to Loch Raven a lot, usually hiking along the trails that surround the reservoir. on your kayak, you have access to places that I've never been. We're overlooking the island that's called Goose Island or Feather Island. Have you actually set foot on it?
Oh, yeah. I've gone all over this area. The reason I used battery motors is because I can get to places that you can't physically get to and get back in time. If you're in a kayak, you can't make it 2 miles and come back. And then there's weather. It can get very touchy out there in a kayak.
Have you ever been stuck out in the middle of...
Yes, I have. And that's the reason I did motors, because I couldn't get back.
Describe what happened when you got stuck in the middle
it's
of the reservoir on a bad
scary.
Day.
It's very scary. It's very scary. It's deep, and it's much bigger than you think. I mean, we're looking out over here, and we're seeing an island, and we're seeing a shore, and everything seems like it's in close proximity. But I wouldn't want to swim from the fishing center to that island. It would be probably 1.5 miles. And it's very deep. It can be completely serene and glass-like. And it can be very, very choppy as well. I was doing a larger book a few years ago that was more like a photographic essay of the beauty of Loch Raven. And in that process, I photographed for about 3 years, and I couldn't stop. I enjoyed it so much, I continued to come out even after the book was published.
Can you talk about your process for making images of Loch Raven? What goes through your mind as you're photographing the wildlife here?
Well, it's sort of getting up as early as possible in the morning. Seeing the fog is the best way to approach it. It's not even mist, it's like a fog. There's something about the temperature of the water and the temperature of the air and how it produces a mist. And early in the morning, 5, 6 in the morning, it's just the most unbelievable light. You know, it's meditative. It's a wonderful thing to experience, especially from the boat. The reason I did the book was the amount of people that fly over the bridges of Loch Raven and never bother to get on the water.
The pictures that you took for this book, The Swan, were all taken from the kayak.
Yes, everyone was taken from the kayak.
But your other book, you took pictures from other vantage points?
I did. The idea was to completely do it from the kayak. I thought that would be really interesting to get people, motivate people to get out on the water here. But what happened is the snow was so beautiful, and the ice and the different seasons. You can't really put a kayak in here in the snow. And it's a disservice not to photograph this place in the winter.
It is beautiful.
Yeah. You could photograph all day today.
Photographer David Simpson's new book is The Swan at Loch Raven. The book's available at the Ivy Bookshop, Greetings and Readings, and Amazon. You can find out more online at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. David Simpson will be reading from the book on March 3rd at a National Reading Month event at Loch Raven United Methodist Church. Information about that event is online, too. From the banks of Loch Raven Reservoir, I'm Nathan Sterner.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland near history, the year 2001, the Baltimore Ravens beat the New York Giants to become Super Bowl champions. Remember? Thanks for listening. We're back Friday.